Shalom. Salam. Peace. In the last year or so, I've taken to saying all three of those words, no matter the community, the gathering to which I'm speaking. Those three words used to be, in separated bubbles, the greetings of three different of the families of Abraham, Hagar, and Sarah. Why say them together? Why not reserve saying shalom to a community, a gathering of Jews, and salam to a gathering of Muslims, and peace, pax, pev, to a gathering of Christians? Because in our generation, there is, in fact, no room in which only Jews or only Christians or only Muslims are present. Because our world is now so small, and the danger or reality of destruction among our families so great, and the possibility of celebration and joy among our families also so great, that when I have been invited to speak to Muslim audiences, I have said all three words. And here, where all or almost all of us here gathered are Christians, I say all three words. And when I speak at a synagogue, I say all three words. And I want you to be clear that in this room, all three families are present. I want you to be clear that in this room, the Jews of the southern Israeli town of Sderot, the families fleeing from their homes in fear of rockets falling, traumatized by the leaving of their homes, that they are here in this room. And I want you to be clear that the families of Gaza, the Muslim families of Gaza, who many of whom have no homes to flee from or to flee to, more than 1,000 dead in the last 3 weeks, that they are here in this room. Even in the midst of the grief and the horror and the anger of these last weeks, I have felt even so a sense of joy that we were coming to that extraordinary, miraculous time when the memory of Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel, whose Yahrzeit, that is the anniversary of his death, came this past week. Heschel, who worked closely with Martin Luther King, who along with King stood together not only against racism in America, that was relatively easy, and they were able to bring a president to work with them, but who stood along with King against the Vietnam War when the president was infuriated, and when their own advisors, their own supporters said, "What are you doing? Civil rights, wonderful. America is ready to move, and the president is ready to move. What are you doing? Throwing away this by standing against the Vietnam War." Heschel and King heartened each other, prayed together in their different modes and metaphors, stood together in the streets of Washington against the war, as well as on the Selma Highway, demanding voting rights. The march from which Heschel came back home to say, "I felt as if my legs were praying." The Heschel who could write lyrically, beautifully, about the nature of prayer. The song, he said, that the universe sings to itself, and then say that prayer is useless unless it is subversive. In a generation in which the word subversive perhaps had more energy, heat in it than it may today, but perhaps it does still. And Dr. King, going to jail, speaking exactly 1 year before his death in Riverside Church in New York City, in a speech presciently called Beyond Vietnam, in which he made clear his own opposition to the Vietnam War and then went deeper and deeper and deeper, talking about what he called the dangerous triplets of American society, racism and militarism and materialism. And a year later, the night before his death, echoed the story of Moses, saying, "I'm standing on the mountaintop looking into the promised land. I may not get there, but the people will." So his real birthday was also this past week, and our country honors his birthday tomorrow. Now that miracle of the confluence of Heschel's Yahrzeit and King's birthday, that miracle comes not every year, but often. But this year we have a special piece of the miracle added on. That the day after the official celebration of Dr. King's birthday, we have the inauguration of a president of the United States. After what, for me at least, seemed to have been almost the worst 8 years in the history of American society. A new opening. A miracle, maybe the obvious miracle, that the work King did 40-some years ago made it possible for an African-American to be elected president of the United States. And so that confluence seems miraculous. But I think there is a deeper miracle that calls on us, not just on the president, to notice. And I want to go deep into the past, not only 40 years ago, but deeper into the past. We have heard the words from the book of Exodus. Shifra and Puah, two midwives. I think of them in relation to Moses as like Rosa Parks in relation to Dr. King. The pioneers. The openers of the way, the birth givers, midwives who had awe for the holiness of life, who didn't need a special voice from heaven to say, "No, you don't kill these newborns," because the wailing, the weeping, the crying, perhaps the laughing of the newborns was voice of God enough. And so we have the story that seems to be the very first story in all of human literature about nonviolent civil disobedience. And that story was read yesterday in every synagogue in the world as we remember Heschel and King, and look forward to a confrontation with all the pharaohs of our lives today. So that's a very long time ago, but we also, especially in this church, can look back more than 40 years ago. It was extraordinary for me to be invited to speak here at Old South Church, the womb, you might say, of the Boston Tea Party. That act of nonviolent civil disobedience, which challenged both Imperial Britain and colonial America to face their future. This thread that runs through history of the willingness to rise without violence against a king, a pharaoh, a president, institutions that oppress, that thread that runs through all of history did not die 40 years ago along with King. That thread is still woven into our lives. That thread is woven in even into the life of what has been violence erupting again and again and again among those two families of Abraham that live in Israel and Palestine. Beginning about 3 months ago, small boats from Europe began to cross the Mediterranean, filled with cargoes of medicine and baby food, to come to Gaza, to break through the blockade, the embargo, that has left Gaza hungry and sick. And for weeks those boats came in and were greeted with joy by the people of Gaza. The last two efforts, I started calling them a ship in. The last two efforts were turned back by the Israeli Navy. Even though the boats had been cleared in Cyprus, certified by the Cypriot authorities that they carried no weapons, but only food and medicine. An attempt at nonviolent civil disobedience. I think wistfully, what if Hamas, instead of responding to the failure of pleas to end the embargo, instead of responding with rocket fire on southern Israel, had responded by asking Europe and Americans to make not half a dozen ship-ins, but hundreds. What would have been the result? And among Israelis as well, Rabbis for Human Rights and other groups, not naming themselves in the religious tradition, but drawing on that deep strand of nonviolent civil disobedience, have stood in the way of bulldozers knocking down Palestinian homes, have worked to help Palestinians bring in the olive harvest that has been so crucial, both symbolically and practically, to their lives, has helped harvest the wheat in the West Bank, have done this often despite the authorities, the military, the police, who stood to, in their way, as they tried to stand in the way or with the path of Palestinian prosperity and hope. So even there, where our news is dominated by violence and death and bloodshed, this effort remains. And in both societies, not from their governments, it's rare that governments encourage, we've just heard the story, rare that governments encourage nonviolence and civil disobedience. Not from their governments, but within both peoples, that intention to resist injustice with nonviolence has arisen. And indeed, one of the leaders of Rabbis for Human Rights, Rabbi Arik Asherman, got his inspiration as an American growing up into choosing the rabbinate and then choosing to go to Israel. Got his vision of what Rabbis for Human Rights could be from having lived in America with Heschel and with King. So now we move, many of us hope, into an era of a government that may be more open to change. And yet, I remember clearly Barack Obama on the night he was elected, saying to the gathering in Grant Park. I was in Grant Park in 1968 in the demonstrations against the Vietnam War that tried to go to the Democratic National Convention in Chicago and were beaten bloody by the police. Grant Park redeemed on election night. The corner of 14th and U Streets in Washington, D.C., where on April 5th, 1968, the day after the murder of Dr. King, the black community erupted in some violence mostly aimed at property. The uprising that whose epicenter was 14th and U. At 14th and U Streets, the night of that election, blacks and whites together singing, celebrating the redemption of 14th and U Streets in Washington, D.C. But what Obama said that night was this. He said, "My election is not the change that we are seeking. It is only the opportunity for change." And he went on to say, the change, looking at that crowd in Grant Park, depends on you. Depends on us. I'm enough of a historian to remember that Franklin Roosevelt, in the depths of the Depression, when there were beginning to be the organizing of what became the industrial unions, the United Mine Workers, the United Auto Workers, called the leaders of these nascent new kinds of unions in and said to them, "I want you to organize the workers to force me to do the things I would like to do. Because if you don't force me to do them, I won't be able to." So I hear what Obama said as both a promise and a warning. If we do not act, then whatever vision he may have of change, of a new kind of American foreign policy that treats the world as a community, not as a bunch of nations to be controlled and dominated. A vision of the earth itself and all its living beings, and even the beings we never thought were living beings, like the proportion of oxygen and CO2 in the atmosphere. Whoever thought that that was life? That all those beings must be treated as part of our community. Though he's made that vision clear, there are institutional pharaohs who are utterly uninterested in making that vision true. His vision of a kind of economic recovery that would make jobs green and make the recovery itself a contribution to the healing of our planet as well as to the healing of our society. That vision is already facing opposition and chipping away at the edges. So the question is, what does it mean for us to say it is for us to do? So there are many avenues. Dr. King went to jail, but he didn't only go to jail. He led marches, but he didn't only lead marches. The only night I ever met him, he was sitting patiently exhausted with a broken leg in one of the rooms of the convention center in Atlantic City in 1964 as the Democratic Convention was about to begin. And the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, that black and white amalgam of people who had been elected in unofficial elections because blacks in 1964 could not vote in Mississippi. So this alternative Democratic Party came to say to the National Democratic Party, seat us instead of the white old boys who have controlled Mississippi for almost a century. The Credentials Committee was meeting on Sunday night. Fannie Lou Hamer addressed them. It was on television and all across the country people were moved. But the president, Lyndon Johnson, was struck with fear and anger. If they were seated, he thought his own state, Texas, would not vote for him for president. And he brought the authority and power, even the FBI, utterly illegally and unconstitutionally, to eavesdrop on and try to twist the decision-making of the Mississippi Freedom Party. And the party had asked Dr. King, who had not been part of this struggle in Mississippi itself, but of course had been throughout the South, to come and meet and talk with members of the Credential Committee, one by one by one. And they were not excited about supporting this dissonant, troublesome group from Mississippi when their president was leaning really hard on them not to do it. So one by one by one, we were able, I was there because I had been a member of a congressional staff and knew some of the members of the Credentials Committee. One by one by one, we persuaded them to come out and talk to Dr. King. And there was no charisma. This was not the king of the great speeches. This was not the king of the great rallies. This was not the king of going to Birmingham jail. This was a king himself exhausted in 105 degrees with a broken leg, patiently explaining again and again and again to these unwilling Democratic officials why it was important to support the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party. So King drew on nonviolent civil disobedience, and he also drew on the means of electoral politics, of lobbying. That's what he was doing that night, was lobbying. So it remains for us to lobby, to elect, to gather in large crowds, and perhaps sometimes to do nonviolent civil disobedience. on March 2nd in Washington, a number of groups committed to heal the earth have called together an act of nonviolent civil disobedience at a coal-powered plant that provides energy to the United States Capitol, the House and Senate office buildings, the Supreme Court, those official buildings in that little cluster right around the Capitol. They're hoping that 1,000 or more people will be prepared nonviolently to sit down at the entrances of that coal-powered plant to say, stop poisoning the earth in order to give power to the Congress. We intend to empower ourselves, the citizens, with power that comes from inside the human heart and soul and body. And the poisoning of the planet with the CO2 that comes from burning coal and oil must stop. Now that may draw, it may call some of us. And I'm sure not all of us. And it doesn't need to call all of us. But the vision of Heschel and King, the vision that said we must live into, work into an America that is free of racism and militarism and the materialism that is poisoning the planet. That call, I think, is a call that speaks to every American. How we respond to that call, we will need to choose. But the future of this country and the future of the human race and the future of the planet and the future of our grandchildren will depend on how and whether we answer that call.